So we're in the final section of our study, and this is the New Testament context, bringing all the stuff that we've learned over the intertestamental period to bear on what we find when we open the New Testament. And I've broken this into three sort of perspectives. One of them is the political perspective, the cultural perspective, and then the religious perspective. So we'll just be unpacking each of those a little bit here in the last few weeks. So the first thing is the political situation. What was the political situation at the time of the New Testament? And of course, it's one of the things we find right away when we read the New Testament is the fact that Judea was under Roman rule becomes very prominent right away. And so we'll take a quick look at that. Rome, of course, was ruled at this point in history by emperors. And I've listed here on your handout the emperors that are important during the New Testament era. And the first of those is Augustus. This was Octavian. We went over the Roman history before on how Octavian ended up conquering during the various wars that happened and the civil wars. Then he took the title of Augustus. He was on the scene from 31 BC up to 14 AD. And this, of course, is the emperor that was in power when Jesus was born. I'm going to be reading a few references here from the New Testament as we go along here. Augustus, of course, is mentioned at the beginning of the birth narrative in Luke. Luke chapter 2, verse 1 says, "In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world." And this was right at the time of Jesus' birth. And the census that was ordered by Caesar Augustus was the reason that Joseph and Mary ended up in Bethlehem. The second emperor was Tiberius, and he was on the scene from 14 AD, succeeding Augustus, until 37 AD. Tiberius is also mentioned in Luke in the very next chapter. Luke chapter 3, verse 1, it says this, "In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea and Trachonitis, and Licinius, tetrarch of Abilene." Here we have a whole number of political figures connected together at this particular time, the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. And we'll be talking about several of these Herods in a few minutes. This was the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, we're told here in Luke, is the year that the word of God came to John the Baptist, that is. So Tiberius Caesar then is on the scene as the emperor at the time when John the Baptist begins to preach, which of course is pretty much coincides with the beginning of Jesus' ministry as well. Then the next emperor following Tiberius was Gaius, who's better known as Caligula to us probably. He had a relatively short reign from 37 AD to 41 AD before he was assassinated. We'll be talking a little bit more about him because he's important for some of the connections with the Herods that we'll be talking about shortly. Following him was Emperor Claudius, and his dates are AD 41 to 54. So you can kind of see what's happening now if you connect that to the book of Acts. And he's mentioned in the book of Acts in two places. Acts 11:28. This is describing the church at Antioch. And if you remember, there was a prophet, Agabus, and picking up in verse 28, it says, "Some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, named Agabus, stood up and through the Spirit predicted that a severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world." And then there's a parenthetical remark in the NIV that says, "This happened during the reign of Claudius." And then also in Acts 18, the other thing that we know about Claudius is he was the one that ordered the Jews out of Rome, picking up in chapter 18, verse 1. "After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome." So Claudius is mentioned two different times in the book of Acts. And then the end of his reign was AD 54. And then the final emperor that I'll mention is Nero. And he reigned after Claudius from AD 54 up until AD 68. He isn't mentioned by name in Acts, but he is the emperor that would have been in view when Paul was on trial. So when Paul stood trial and appealed to the emperor, that would have been Emperor Nero at the time. So those are the emperors that cover from the beginning of the New Testament, the birth of Jesus, up until the last writings that we have of Paul. Now, there are other emperors in view here that aren't mentioned, per se, in the scriptures. For instance, the Apostle John was exiled much later, and so there are later emperors that the apostles would have known and may have had contact with after this, but they're not mentioned in scripture, so I stopped at Nero. So those are the Roman emperors that were on the scene at this time during the New Testament era. And the Roman Empire was divided up into provinces. And one prominent province in the Middle East was the province of Syria. That was a large, very important province. It was viewed as the Romans as sort of the edge of the empire, so it was sort of their boundary between the east and west. So it was a very important political province and tended to have a ruler who had a lot of authority relative to Judea. So Judea, early on, was added to that province of Syria, so it was part of that jurisdiction. That happened in 63 BC. Later, Judea was made a standalone province. It would have included the territories of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. And in AD 6, well, it remained a minor province, but in AD 6, at the banishment of one of the Herods, which we'll talk about in a minute, it came under the rule directly of a Roman procurator, which is the scene that we find during the trial of Jesus. We have Pilate there. So the point is that Judea, although it was its own province, was a relatively minor province. And when you read Josephus, you find that the province of Syria still had a lot of authority over Judea. If there were any troubles in Judea, often the ruler of Syria would intervene on behalf of the Romans in Judea. And we see that type of thing happening when Archelaus was banished in AD 6. Okay, so Judea was under Roman control at this time. What were some of the characteristics of the Roman government? The Roman government basically had three purposes when they governed a province, particularly one that would be on their military frontier. One of them was to provide military protection and to maintain the peace, military occupation. The other would be to collect taxes for the empire. And then the third was to administer justice. And so just taking each of those in turn briefly, military protection and occupation to maintain the peace. Well, one thing that's pervasive in the New Testament, in the Gospels, and even in the book of Acts, is that the military presence of Rome is pervasive. You see it throughout the New Testament, in the Gospels particularly. We see references to Roman soldiers, centurions, even whole regiments, if you remember. Some of them are even called by name, like the Italian regiment. So the military presence is pervasive in the New Testament. How about collecting taxes? Well, that's something else that we see a lot of in the New Testament, particularly in the Gospels. The Romans used local tax collectors to help collect taxes and send them to Rome. Now, you can imagine, and we see this played out in the New Testament, those tax collectors were not viewed very favorably. They were disdained for helping the occupiers and also turning a profit themselves. That's typically what they would try to do. So they had a reputation as being corrupt and on behalf of an occupying force, taking money and then keeping some of it before they turned the rest over to the government. There's some striking stories about that. Even earlier, not particularly with Rome, but with Egypt in the earlier days of the Ptolemies, there's some striking stories about how it was a privilege for them to be the ones that collected the taxes. They actually bid for the title, bid for the ability to collect the taxes. So during the Ptolemaic period, there's a story of one of these individuals who paid an enormous sum of money to be able to collect the taxes. And then you can imagine he's trying to turn a profit, so he's taking all kinds of money from the people to make his investment back and then make money on it. And he still has to pass the taxes on to the rulers. So I imagine that maybe to a little lesser extent, the same thing was going on with the Roman tax collectors. But there's a number of references in the New Testament to this, so let's just take a quick look at some of these. Luke 18. There's really a lot of examples to pick from, but just to highlight a couple, Luke 18, we actually have a parable here. Luke 18, this is the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. So picking up in verse 10, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself, 'God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get.' But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, 'God, have mercy on me, a sinner.' I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." So here we have a great parable about what our heart attitude should be towards the Lord, and we also get an insight into what the Pharisee thought of the tax collector. I'm not even like this tax collector. In Matthew chapter 9, this is Matthew 9, starting in verse 9, this is the calling of Matthew. So we see here the attitude of people towards the tax collectors. "As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. 'Follow me,' he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, 'Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?' On hearing this, Jesus said, 'It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. Go then and learn what this means: I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners.'" So there you can again see the attitude towards tax collectors. And of course, Jesus had no qualms at all about consorting with sinners, like tax collectors and prostitutes and things like that. And then Matthew chapter 18, verse 17. Of course, this is the passage really about church discipline. Matthew chapter 18, picking up at verse 17. "If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church, and if he refuses to listen even to the church, treat him as you would a pagan or a tax collector." So you can see there how tax collectors are viewed. They're basically lumped in with people who are outside the covenant community. Pagans and tax collectors are the same level. Now, there are different kinds of taxes that were collected at this time. You know, we know that there was a temple tax, but what I'm talking about here is the tax that went to the Romans as part of the government. Okay, and then the third pillar of Roman purposes was to administer justice. And here the Roman governors had much local authority, up to and including capital punishment, as we see in the case of Jesus' trial. This is, of course, pictured in many different ways in the New Testament, too. One of the ways that I thought of that you definitely see it in play is in Acts chapter 19. You may recall that when Paul was in Ephesus, a riot broke out, and the people basically stampeded into the theater in Ephesus and were causing a ruckus. It's interesting, you can get a picture into the Roman government if you read the end of there. After they had been chanting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," for 2 hours, this man stood up, the city clerk actually, and he says here, picking up in verse 38, "If then Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a grievance against anybody, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. They can press charges. If there is anything further you want to bring up, it must be settled in a legal assembly. As it is, we are in danger of being charged with rioting because of today's events. In that case, we would not be able to account for this commotion, since there is no reason for it." And after he had said this, he dismissed the assembly. So notice what his argument is there. If we don't break up here, we're all going to be on trial for violating the laws. And what laws would those be? They would have been the laws of the Romans for public order and peace. The Romans looked very disfavorably on rulers who were not able to keep the peace. And we see that over and over again in Judea through the years. And some of the rulers were banished because of that. Not so much because of their corruption or what they did, but the perception that they weren't able to keep control of the territory that they were governing. And we'll see some examples of that coming up when we look at the governors and the Herods. So this is a good example right here of the Roman law and the Roman desire to keep the peace and administer justice. And we also know that the Roman citizens, at least, had rights to appeal if they felt that they were unjustly sentenced. And we see that in the case of Paul, when he found that he wasn't getting justice and that that was sort of a kangaroo court that was trying him, he appealed to Caesar. And his appeal was upheld, and he was eventually sent off to Rome. So we see that Roman justice system in play in several places in the New Testament. Now, the Romans also allowed a good deal of self-governance, which we also see in the New Testament. So the Jews in Judea had a lot of opportunity to govern themselves. And what would have been their standard for governing? Anybody want to take a guess? The Law of Moses, the Old Testament. So the Jews governed by the Law of Moses, the Old Testament law. And they had many local ruling bodies. So their ruling body was called a Sanhedrin. We'll talk about that when we get under the religious perspective later. But the Sanhedrin was a court that typically included 7 members. And then the Supreme Council, which sort of be like the Supreme Court in Jerusalem, was composed of 70 members in addition to the presiding high priest. But they had the ability, and we see this several times in the New Testament, of cases being brought into the Jewish courts, so not going before the Roman court. Now, the one thing that the Jews were not permitted was capital punishment. And we see that in the New Testament, particularly in the case of Jesus. In John 18:31, capital punishment was not permitted for them. But they did have the ability to inflict other punishments. The two common punishments that we see in the New Testament were flogging. And that's the 39 lashes would be an example of that, up to 39 lashes. And then expulsion from the synagogue, or it's really from the covenant community. And we see that threatened many times as well in the New Testament. And we'll get to some of those. I have the references here. We'll actually look at some of those cases when we get down under the religious perspective. Okay, with that, we'll pick up the Roman governors. Are there any questions or comments up to this point? Yes, Ginny. That's an excellent question. Stephen was executed by the Jews, apparently by the Jews, from what we can tell. He was stoned, and the question is, why was that allowed? Was it just a religious court or not? I think that that is an exception that probably they would have been held accountable for, if there was any accountability at that time. They didn't have the permission to authority to execute someone, even in a religious case. The Romans reserved that right for themselves, so I think in that case with Stephen, we have a mob scene, basically, that got out of control, and they rushed Stephen out of the city and stoned him. Probably they all dispersed pretty quickly after that, I'm guessing, in case the Romans would find out about it. Yes, Greg?
Also, Paul, of course, was approving of Stephen's death.
Right, that's an excellent point. Pastor was referring to the fact that there are other executions that must have happened because Paul gave approval to Stephen's death, but also he was persecuting other Christians to the death. Basically, I think the way you would describe that is possible the Romans just look the other way with things like that, because maybe they would see that as being in their best interest, because somebody who was disturbing the peace of the local community was being kind of taken care of by the local community. So it's possible it could have been a pragmatic exception that they made. Yes, Dave.
A couple questions. First of all, pertaining to the stoning, Jesus actually...
The question is, why wasn't Caligula or Gaius Caligula mentioned in the Bible? I think because the writers of the Bible were only incidentally giving information just to support their point. Apparently, Gaius didn't figure into any of their points that they needed to make at the time. And it was a relatively short period. And if you look at where it was, it's kind of in between the Gospels and the book of Acts, too. Yes, Robin. Yeah, excellent point. Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. Robin was just pointing out that there was a lot of pressure on the governors to appease the Jews for political purposes. They wanted to be in good relationship with the Jews. So that could have been another reason why they looked the other way in some of these cases. Yes, Daniel. Yeah, that's a good point. So Daniel was pointing out that when Pilate gave the people a choice between Jesus and Barabbas, he seems to be not doing himself a favor, because Barabbas was an insurrectionist and had committed murder, most likely in some kind of a revolt situation against the Romans. But you have to realize, you know, in Pilate's mind, he's got this one guy who, if he releases, you know, is probably going to go his own way and never cause trouble again. And then he's got Jesus with the mob scene again. So he's got torn motives there. One of them, I don't want to let this guy go because he's against the Roman government. But on the other hand, I have a mob scene here, and I need to appease the whole people, and they're asking for this guy to be released. So I'm not sure that that's a contradiction or an inconsistency. I think he was just being expedient at the moment. What's the lesser of two evils for me here? But yeah, that's a good point, because he really would want to have executed both of them, probably. Okay, any other questions or comments? Some of the comments are picking up on the governors, which is what our next topic is here. Incidentally, this gets very confusing. I wanted to make a nice table that shows when the emperors were in power, what governors were there, what Herods were on the scene, and there's other information that you'd want to put in that. The problem is things overlap a lot, and especially with the Herods and the governors, there's a lot of interaction, so there's not a uniform picture of what was happening in Judea, because then Judea was broken up into many different pieces. And so these people were coming and going, overlapping rules and stuff like that. And jurisdictions were changing. So I wasn't able to make that easy table. But I did want to point out that there is a version of that full table in the ESV Study Bible. So if you have an ESV Study Bible, there's a two-page table that has basically all that information in small print that you can read if you want to see how all these people lined up. Okay, so Roman governors. What was a Roman governor? Roman governors are called different things. They're called prefects. They're sometimes called procurators. And they were set up over Judea and Samaria when one of the Herods, Archelaus, was banished in AD 6. And as I mentioned, we'll get to why he was banished in a few minutes. But there were a number of governors that were set up over Judea. Josephus talks about all of these guys. I'm just listing them here in your handout. You can see their dates. Coponius was the first one that came into Judea that was appointed when Herod was banished. And then we have Marcus Ambivius. These names are challenging to say sometimes. Annius Rufus. He was the last governor that was appointed by Caesar Augustus. And then after Augustus, Tiberius came on the scene. And so Valerius Gratus was the first procurator appointed by Tiberius Caesar. He's important because he is the one that dismissed Annas as the high priest. Annas is the high priest that we find in the New Testament, sometimes called Annas. And he eventually installed Joseph Caiaphas in his place. There were some others in between there, but his son Joseph Caiaphas was installed in his place. And that's the scene that we see in the New Testament, with particularly in Jesus' trial. So these Roman governors were appointing the high priest at that time that we find in the Bible. And then in AD 26, Pontius Pilate came on the scene as the governor. He ruled from 26 to 36 AD. And it's interesting, you get a little bit of insight into his character in the New Testament with the thing that had happened where he mixed the blood of the people. You might remember that question that Jesus got, or that Jesus asked. This is referred to in Luke 13, verse 1. Now there were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. And then Jesus goes on to, of course, talk about God's providential control over bad things that happen to people. So we get a little bit of insight there into Pilate doing some seedy things behind the scene. And then pretty much the other evidence that we have is at Jesus' trial, when Pilate, you know, seems to be spineless and gives an innocent man over to be crucified. But in reality, he was a pretty bad, harsh governor. So the instance in Luke 13:1 was not an isolated incident. He was known as a very harsh and cruel leader. He clashed with the Jews on several occasions. And Josephus records some of those clashes. One of them was when he tried to bring the Roman standards into Jerusalem and set them up, which caused a riot, and there were a number of other instances that are recorded where he clashed with the Jews. He was not friends with the Herods either. Agrippa I, in particular, Agrippa I, Herod Agrippa I, was not a friend of Pilate. And Philo, the historian, quotes Agrippa I as reproaching him, quote, for the taking of bribes, wanton insolence, rapacity, outrages, countless and continuous murders, endless and most painful cruelty. Okay, so that's a secular writer, well, secular by most accounts, Philo. And then I have another quote here from another individual. I think this is on your, this quote there is on your handout. The administration of Pilate is described by Philo, that's what we were just reading, as a harsh and corrupt regime. We are told that Pilate was widely disliked, that he was influenced by bribery, and that he angered the Jews by his extortions and frequent executions without trial. You know, in the New Testament, you might get the impression that Pilate was concerned with justice, but he just didn't have the spine to stand up for it. And in reality, he was frequently doing things that were unjust and harsh and executing people without trial. And I mentioned he was at odds with the Herods. And we have an example of this in Luke chapter 23 when, if you remember, Herod Antipas, remember he sent Jesus to Herod? This was Herod Antipas at the time. And it says when he did that, that Herod and Pilate became friends that day. And so that shows that prior to that, they were not friends. They were at odds. Pilate also was likely on a very precarious footing with Rome. We get a little bit of insight into that as well. So this would have been one of the reasons why he was motivated to hand Jesus over to be executed. But we get a little bit of insight into that at Jesus' trial in, let me see if I have this reference right, John 19:12. You remember this quote, from then on, this is when he was interrogating Jesus and Jesus was responding to him. And in particular, he says, you wouldn't have any power if it wasn't given to you from above, which kind of scared Pilate a little bit. We also know that his wife had had a dream about Jesus that had also frightened him. But from then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free. But the Jews kept shouting, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. So you can see there a not-so-veiled threat that if you let this guy go, you're opposing Caesar, and maybe Caesar's going to find out about this if you let him go. Okay, so you can see that he was probably on a little bit of a precarious footing with Rome at the time, and that type of a threat would have been something that had a lot of weight with him. So because of that, then, he unjustly put Jesus to death. Again, so that would be for political expediency. You handed Jesus over to death for political expediency. And finally, for Pilate, he was removed from power in AD 36 because of the charges of brutality. There was an incident in Samaria where he attacked a bunch of Samaritans on Mount Gerizim, and they protested that to Rome, and he was finally removed from power by the Romans and sent off. He probably wasn't exiled necessarily because of his brutality towards the Samaritans. Probably just as much in play there was his inability to keep the peace from Rome's perspective. There were a number of these disturbances with Pilate and the people that he was governing. And probably at some point the Romans said, okay, enough is enough. We got to get this guy out of there and get somebody in there who can keep the peace. Now, there is a short period in the history of the governors where there wasn't a Roman governor, and Herod Agrippa actually ruled the entire territory. And this was in AD 41 to 44. Herod was on good terms with Gaius Caligula, and he was given that territory to rule right before Caligula was assassinated. So he had the distinction of being the main ruler in Judea and pretty much over all of Palestine, pretty much the whole territory of Herod the Great, that 3 or 4 year period from 41 to 44. And then there's a whole list of governors that we know about. I've cut them all out and just mentioned here that there were later governors that show up in the New Testament. They took over rule of Palestine again after the death of Herod Agrippa. The one prominent one that we know about from the book of Acts is Felix from Paul's imprisonment. This is recorded in Acts 24, verses 10 through 27. Josephus also records information about Felix. And I have a quote here from Tacitus. So Felix was actually an imperial freedman. There were a lot of these people ruling for the Romans, imperial freedmen, so they would have been former slaves, and for some reason or another they had come into favor with the Romans and were freed, and many of these people were given places of authority. So Felix was an imperial freedman, that is, a former slave. And Tacitus says of him, in every way of cruelty and lust, He used a king's power in a slave's spirit. So he's got a lot of authority and power, but he's using it with a slave spirit. So in other words, he's not refined enough to know how to use it properly. Felix, we know from the book of Acts, Drusilla is mentioned. It says that he had married a Jewess, Drusilla. And we know that he had actually seduced and married a daughter of Agrippa the First, Drusilla. And then Robin mentioned this earlier. Note that when Felix left office, he performed a favor for the Jews by leaving Paul in prison. So you can see there the relationship between the Roman governor and the Jews again. There's still this relationship where they want to keep the peace and stay on good footing with one another. And so just in the case of Jesus, we have here a case where Felix knew that Paul was innocent, but because he wanted to stay on good terms with the Jews, he did them a favor and left Paul in prison. And then following Felix, Porcius Festus came on the scene. He was the governor from AD 60 to 62, which coincides well with what we know about Paul's trial and then his subsequent trip to Rome. This is recorded in Acts 24:27 through chapter 26, verse 31. He listened to Paul with Herod Agrippa the second. This is a different Herod Agrippa now. This is Agrippa the second. Porcius Festus listened to Paul with him, you might remember from that story. And note that he also wanted to do the Jews a favor by having Paul stand trial in Jerusalem. He, again, knew that Paul was innocent, but the Jews were demanding that he be transferred back to Jerusalem and put on trial there before their court, and he wanted to do the Jews a favor. So he asked Paul, would you be willing to go and stand trial basically before the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem? And that's when Paul said, you have no right to send me to the Sanhedrin. I'm charged before Caesar's court, and that's where I'm standing, and therefore I have to appeal to Caesar, which is what he did, and of course to Caesar he went. So both of these governors that are recorded in the book of Acts were trying to do the Jews a favor to stay on good footing with them. And for political expediency, they were subverting justice for that purpose. So that's pretty much what we know about the Roman governors. Yes, Greg? Yeah, that's an excellent point, because how many of us have read that passage where Herod says to Festus, if this man had not appealed to Rome, he could have been set free. How many of us have read that and said, oh, what a bummer, you know, and without, you know, really thinking from God's perspective that he's in control of all these contingencies, if you will, and the same thing is true in our lives when we think, oh, if I'd only done A instead of B. We have to have confidence that God is in control of all of our circumstances, and including our decisions that we make, and he's going to use that for our good and his glory. Yeah, that's an excellent point. It also shows what I was saying, that Festus knew Paul was innocent. He even had confirmation from Agrippa that he was innocent and he could have been set free. So just in summary, with respect to the Roman rule here, the Bible presents a picture of politically minded governors who were repeatedly willing to subvert justice for personal political gain. And these accounts are corroborated by the secular sources. I read from a number of different authors here, Philo, Tacitus, and Josephus has a lot of information about this that corroborates the picture that we find of these rulers in the New Testament. So that's part A there on the outline, Roman rule. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Pastor. Yep, excellent point. I won't try to repeat that for the tape other than to say that Pastor is doing an excellent job applying this, the lessons learned from here to our own day. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Sometimes we can have a little bit of a romantic view of the Roman government. You know, we think, oh, the Roman government, and they had all this justice and everything, and they did have a modicum of justice, and they were trying enough to maintain the public peace, right, for their own political expediency. But it's very parallel to the things we see in our day. We have a modicum of justice as well. We wish we had more, but there was never a golden age when there was this just government in place that God's people were subject to. Yeah, it's a lot of lessons here for our own day, for sure. Any other questions or comments? We've got 4 minutes left, so maybe I will draw your attention to the handout in the couple minutes we have left. You can see it's a photocopy from my Bible with the thin pages, so the words on the other side come through almost equally as good. I couldn't find this chart anywhere other than in my Bible, so I really like it. There's many different charts of the Herods. There is a nice family chart also in the ESV Study Bible. That's on page 1790 in the ESV Study Bible, if you have one at home. It's more like a genealogical tree. It's very helpful. This one I like because it not only has the genealogy, but it also has the map up above it of where the people were reigning. When I mentioned that the territories were changing and people were reigning concurrently and overlapping, it's kind of hard to get that picture unless you look at this chart. You can see where the territories were as well. So it's very helpful. It also has the interconnection of the females, like Herodias, for instance. You can see the dotted line to Antipas, a heavier dotted line over to Herod Philip I. If you ever are confused about who all these Herods were and all these women that they're marrying and who were sons of whom, this is a really helpful thing to just stick in your Bible at that point if you don't have this particular Bible. I've looked at this thing many times over the years. Okay, so I think I'll stop here. The sources for the Herods, our primary source here is Josephus. He has a lot to say about the Herods in both his Wars of the Jews and Antiquities. Actually, several books in the Antiquities, books 17 through 20, are really just a history of the Herods. I was reading this morning in book 18 for a couple chapters, and there's all kinds of details that we don't have in the New Testament about who these people were, how they interacted with the Roman government, a lot of the political intrigues and the little things that were happening all behind the scenes all the time. So it's very interesting reading. If you have any time this week and you want to get caught up, look at Josephus' Antiquities, start picking up at 17.8. That's book 17, chapter 8. Which picks up from the death of Herod the Great. And then a couple secondary sources, the ones I've been using all along. Bruce's New Testament History has several chapters on the Herods, which is very helpful. If you have that book, I know some of you do, chapters 2, 19, and 20 would be good reading for the coming week. And then I'm using Merrill Tenney's New Testament Times as well. Okay, any last questions or comments? Yes, Janelle. Yes, that was Herod the Great. I think it was Mariamne. I'm not positive about this, but see at the bottom there, Mother Mariamne? That could be her. Herod the Great executed almost his entire family. His mother, multiple sons, in-laws. We covered that earlier, but yeah, he was really a paranoid individual who killed all kinds of people. So, and actually wanted other people to be executed when he was dead so that the population would mourn. upon his passing. And I believe it was Mariamne there that he executed. She was a Hasmonean princess, so she was from the Hasmonean dynasty. And he married her to try to be viewed as a Jewish person. So yeah, good question.